Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Michael Edwards. He is with the think tank Demos in New York, the Wagner School of Public Service at New York University, and the Brooks World Poverty Institute at Manchester University in the UK, and used to be director of the Ford Foundation's Governance and Civil Society program. He worked for the World Bank, Oxfam, Save the Children. His new book is called Small Change: Why Business Won't Save the World. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be with you.
Now, this is a slim volume that is designed to question the kind of going trend in today's thinking that if you just start doing everything along a business model, then we will solve all the world's problems. And it's not that there aren't, as you discuss in the book, places where a business model is helpful, but that's not the whole story, and the trend in philanthropy is toward this business model.
That's right. I really wrote the book as a wake-up call, if you like, because I see some real dangers in the trend that you've described. I mean, it has become almost an article of faith over the last couple of years that business is best, not just in economic terms, where we might accept that it has obviously a key role to play, but in solving our social problems as well. And so I wrote the book as a sort of journey of exploration to try and find out where this movement was coming from and what impact it was actually having on the ground. And what I found, I have to say, alarmed me even more, because my fear is that importing the values and methods of business and the marketplace will actually erode the strength and independence of voluntary citizen action, and it will lead over time to less social change and not more, despite the common perception from the business side that when you bring business into the equation, it makes non-profits and philanthropy more efficient and effective. I actually see very little evidence of that, but I see quite a lot of damage on the horizon, and that makes me very nervous.
One of the problems is that business is the creator of the problem in a lot of cases, and so there's no reason to think that business would solve the very problems that it's creating.
Well, you would think that, but in fact, many of the people who are behind this so-called revolution think the opposite. I think they feel if you're successful in business, if you demonstrated that you can do it, if you can get results in that world, then why wouldn't you be able to get the same results in social problem solving too? I don't think there's a basic questioning at all that these are different worlds that run on different values and principles, and I think that's one of the biggest problems. It's not an insincere belief, but it's an unthinking one, that you can simply translate the bottom line, the profit motive, competition, and all the other stuff that comes from business into the world of civil society and social transformation. But I think there's a real self-confidence here that if you make it big time, you know, if you've made $1 billion or more than $1 billion in your business work, then you'll be just as successful when you try and solve social problems or find a cure for malaria. So it may sound very up, but I think there's, as I say, an overarching sense of optimism and self-confidence and self-belief that they can do it.
Just recently, we had some people from St. Elizabeth's homeless shelter here in Santa Fe on the air, and before we got on the air, I had just read your book, and I was talking to them about it, and they just laughed. They said, there's no business model that can help people who are homeless. People who are homeless are that way because of the recession and because business isn't working for them.
I think that's right. And also, you could argue that there are lots of areas, important areas of life, problems that we want to solve, which will never generate a profit, which will never make a return on investment. And that means, because making a return on investment is fundamental to this new business model, philanthrocapitalism, as some people have called it, there are inevitably going to be huge areas of social life which won't be touched, which will be underinvested, which will be neglected or marginalized in business terms, even though they remain very, very important. The homeless shelter would be a classic one. But when you think about it, you know, the way in which we care for each other, the way in which we build strong communities, things like this will never make a profit. And in the past, people didn't go into this world in order to make a financial gain. That just sounds very odd. But I think, again, because business tends to work on that perspective with a very clear sense of what the financial bottom line is, then they won't go into areas where they can't make some money, where the returns are not evident, and that will privilege certain parts of social problem solving, and that will marginalize others. So you may find a growing gap, in fact, between places like homeless shelters, which simply can't compete on those terms, and some other, if you like, sexier areas that business wants to invest in because it knows it can both make some money and help to solve a problem along the way.
I suppose one example of making money and solving a problem along the way, the classic example would be green technology. So people who do renewable energy work basically can eventually get rid of coal and fossil fuels and so on, are both making money and doing some good.
Yeah, that's a great example. If you think about more efficient solar-powered lighting in Africa or safer wood-based cooking stoves which use less fuel, or any of the sort of green technologies you mentioned, or I would say vaccine research, the kind of stuff that the Gates Foundation is doing, subsidizing corporations to find new vaccines for HIV, AIDS, or malaria. I mean, those are all very good examples of where business and the market can do a hell of a lot of good, and good luck to it. I think that's a great development, and we should encourage it. But that's only a small part of the social problem equation, if you like, and when one gets to more complicated, more deeply embedded issues, more political issues, if you like, issues of discrimination or exclusion or racism or gender injustice, things like that, then there are no vaccines available. There isn't a direct parallel. And the problem comes when what's successful in one area, like green technology, is suddenly considered to be successful in those much more complicated areas, and that's where you get the problem. So it's a matter of finding the right instruments to deliver the right sorts of results. And if we could actually get, let me say it this way, a little bit more humility into the business brain, then we will be able to have a more sensible conversation about where it makes sense to use business models and where it doesn't.
You wrote somewhere in your book that it would work much better if capitalism were the servant rather than the master of democracy and the public good. And I think that's a great shift for some people, but it does make an awful lot of sense, and it has some real historical precedence even in our own country.
Yes, I think if you look at any great period of social reform, at least over the last 100 years, and not just in the United States, but I think globally, you'll find that that saying that capitalism should be the servant of democracy and the public good is actually what happened. The New Deal, the Great Society, for example, in this country, the civil rights movement, the development of countries in East Asia after World War II, even, in a sense, places like China and Vietnam today, although democracy is underdeveloped, have all seen the market and business and the production of economic wealth as, if you like, instrumental to the higher purpose of building the good society. That these things are not ends in themselves. They need to be carefully nurtured, controlled, regulated, directed, if you like, towards socially useful ends. Otherwise, they don't get there, and they become, as I say, an end in themselves and end up being rather destructive. But it's, I think, very difficult for many people on the business side to accept that basic truth of history, because it places them, if you like, in a secondary position. It says that you're here to serve our purposes rather than us being here to serve yours. And I think although that makes perfect sense historically and politically, it is quite threatening, or certainly challenging, to many in the business community who've grown up now to be on top of the pile and, in a sense, to be in charge of democracy and the public interest and not its servants.
You write in the book Small Change, Why Business Won't Save the World, about Adam Smith. And Adam Smith wrote a couple of books, including The Wealth of Nations, which everybody knows about but almost nobody has read, and The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which Adam Smith himself, as you write, thought was more important. And the two represent philosophies of being a human being and of economics that never were really fully integrated in Adam Smith's mind and still aren't.
That's correct. You know, there's a hidden history here that's very fascinating about Smith. Because although, of course, he did write that basic textbook of what people see as a basic textbook of free market economics, he knew that that wasn't enough to answer the great problems of society. And so he wrote his other book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, to try and balance the equation by saying that you do need a successful market economy which does produce wealth, but you also need people to recognize that they need to surrender some of their self-interest to the needs of the community as a whole. Because if they don't do that, then the invisible hand won't actually get us to where we want to go. But unfortunately, his second book, The Theory of Moral Sentiment, has largely been forgotten, and it's only the first one that people remember. So we're still trying to resolve this basic tension in society between economics and the social whole, between finding a way of producing jobs and distributing goods and services efficiently, but not at the cost of some of the things that we really care about as human beings in our deeper nature. And he was struggling himself to do that in his writing, but failed, and I think we've still failed. But what's interesting is that current debates about philanthropy, into which this book is catapulted, are, if you like, an updated version of the same problem, the same conversation. We're still trying to find a better way of organizing ourselves to reap the benefits of both the capitalist economy and, if you like, a non-capitalist society, if I can put it that way. And my worry is that by injecting business ever further into the social side of the equation, into the way we organize ourselves to solve social problems, into our community life, into our volunteer associations, into our philanthropic foundations, we're going to push that debate ever further to one side and forget that that's not the way in which we're going to solve our problems. So there's a real danger here of forgetting some basic lessons of history and allowing ourselves to be seduced into the myth, because I think that's what it is, that the market will solve all our problems for us. That was never what Smith was saying, and it remains a myth today.
I think it's important to step back for a moment and talk about civil society. That's a term that's a little bit hard to define, but it's the whole universe of activities that are outside of both the market and government.
That's right. Everything we do together, not because we want to make a profit or because government tells us to do it, but because we care enough to take collective action. So everything from the local fire department and ladies auxiliary to the HIV/AIDS support council to churches and mosques and religious organizations to self-help and community groups. And these groups tend to be sort of forgotten in the mainstream, but they're actually incredibly important, especially socially and politically with a small p, because they enable ordinary people to come together and argue about the great issues of the day, to solve problems for themselves or to decide what problems they want to solve, free of the constraints, if you like, of either government or the market. So we want to preserve and protect and extend civil society as much as possible, because it what makes a different vision of society possible. It is what gives us the social energy, if you like, the social commitment to make things happen both in our communities and beyond. And I have a real worry that importing the logic of business and the market into civil society in that way will actually erode those commitments. Because let's face it, if someone is going to pay you to do something, why should you volunteer? Or if someone says to you, well, we'll only do this if we can make a financial return, if we can make some money on it, then why would you do it? But civil society has always operated on that radically different sense of principles. Here is something that we need to do because it's the right thing to do, not because we make some money by doing it. So I'm very worried that some of those deeper traditions that make societies work, that help them to function effectively, are under threat from the importation of the business model.
And I think the distinction is not whether you're paid to do it or whether you volunteer, because there are plenty of people who are paid usually very low wages to do this work, which is extremely important to those who are left outside the market model and so on, like in the homeless shelter and in the arts. I mean, I think the distinction is really one of values, like what is actually important.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I take that point, and of course, it's very interesting to see that many of the new foundations don't actually invest in things like better jobs with higher wages and benefits in homeless shelter and things like that. If they did, I'd be much more enthusiastic, but they tend to leave that aside completely and leave those groups desperately under-resourced, which always is a problem for their effectiveness. But underlying the issue of money, you're right, is a deeper issue of values and principles and what we believe in, because I think there's a fundamental difference between caring and cooperation and compassion and love for each other and solidarity and acting out from those principles in a very different form of relationship with each other and the relationships of the marketplace, which are based on how much you have and how much you can pay and how well you can compete with other, often leading to problems of domination and monopoly, just like in the real marketplace. But it's interesting that those fundamental differences in values often go by the wayside in these debates. People either don't recognize them or they pretend they don't exist. And they simply say, I've been part of many conversations like this, that we have to make nonprofit organizations compete with each other just like companies in the marketplace, so that the less efficient ones will go to the wall, they'll go out of existence, which is frightening because it means that those organizations which are having a tough time for various reasons, many of which are not of their own making, simply won't be able to survive any longer. And those who will suffer as a result when they go out of business, so to speak, will be those who need their services most. So I'm very much against the importation of competition and so on into the nonprofit sector, even though we all want to compete with each other for ideas and to do the best job, I accept that. But formal competition of the kind that animates the marketplace, I think has no place at all in meeting real human needs.
I think there's also a really major distinction to be made between effectiveness and efficiency. As you write in the book, there's a, I think it was a Stanford University study that found that the most effective nonprofit organizations were the ones with the strongest missions. It didn't mean that they were organized in some kind of super organized business model. Often it was the exact opposite.
Yeah, it's an interesting finding, isn't it, that the most effective social movements are the most disorganized. You know, that doesn't mean that they're not focused on doing their job or getting results. They are, but they're not, as you say, organized in a kind of business way. And there's much more evidence in addition to that Stanford study that tends to make the same point. There were 25 studies recently done by a group called Seedco, which is a group based in New York, of examples where business was increasingly influential in the provision of social services and so on. And they found that 22 out of the 25 had serious problems of mission drift. In other words, pushing the organization away from its original mission to serve social needs regardless of income, towards areas which made more of a return and away from areas which were more expensive on a per capita basis. And that's the fundamental issue that you pointed out. If you measure efficiency as business does, as lowering per capita costs or unit costs or in the best bang for your buck in the conventional financial sense, you're inevitably going to move away from some really important areas of social problem solving which don't fit the criteria but can still be very, very effective in their own. So importing a business-like definition of efficiency into groups which run on different principles is fatal because it will mean that you privilege some at the expense of others and not the ones that make the biggest impact. That's what's clear from the research that we have, including the Stanford study that you quoted.
We're talking to Michael Edwards about the book Small Change, Why Business Won't Save the World. When I was reading it and when you were talking, I was thinking about a book I read many years ago by an ethnobotanist named Mark Plotkin, and he talked about going to some Amazon rainforest Indians and seeing their garden. And their garden looked completely chaotic. And for people who are used to laying out gardens in rows with separate plants in separate areas, it didn't make any sense. But when he actually studied it, it was the interaction of all these different plants. Some of them were fixing nitrogen and some of them were taking it up. And this apparent chaos was the most well thought out and effectively planted garden you could possibly imagine. And you make the distinction in your book between thinking about philanthropy and thinking about civil society as an ecosystem as opposed to a giant machine, which is more the business model. And those two different metaphors are really worth exploring and thinking about.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that point. It's a great analogy, I think. Just like in a real or a natural ecosystem, civil society, the way we work together as citizens to solve our problems, requires a huge diversity of institutions and relationships, people doing lots of different things in different ways, but coming together to share them and collaborate. And that's because we all have different ideas. We have different things to bring to the table. We interpret things differently. So we can't be shoehorned into a sort of business model. You have to give things time. And there's a lot of examples where, in a business mindset, taking a large amount of time to do something, talking it through, bringing people to the table, you know, doing community organizing, respecting those differences, those are all very time-intensive activities. And when you think about it, if you were ever to monetize them, they might be seen as very inefficient in financial terms. But they're absolutely essential to the health of civil society because that's the way that everyone has a chance to have their voices listened to and to participate in the processes of problem solving. so you can't rush them. But of course, that doesn't fit at all with the business way of doing things, which is to squeeze out as much time and money as possible in order to boost the bottom line. So a really healthy, diverse, dynamic ecosystem of voluntary organizations and relationships is great for society at large, but it's a disaster for business. And I've seen this many times where philanthropists who do come from the business world are deeply frustrated by the sheer difficulty of mobilizing citizens on the ground to do things, because you can't tell them what to do. You know, they don't fit into that pattern. They have to be nurtured and encouraged to do things in their own way and find their own answers, which are relevant to the context over time. That was your point in terms of the analogy of the ecosystem that you talked about when you first asked me the question. So it's actually a great demonstration of the differences that exist between these two worlds and why you can't simply combine them and hope that you're going to get the same result. But I think for business, it's very difficult because they do want to control. They do want to predict things because that's the way you have a good and effective business model. You know, if you have a supply chain of suppliers who are producing tables or musical instruments or lighting or whatever, wherever it happens to be, you can't simply let them go and let them do what they like. That would be disastrous for your business. So you've got to have a very, very detailed set of controls over the way in which the product is produced and distributed in order to lower your costs. But when you transfer that to the kind of area we're talking about, the way we work with each other as human beings, it's disastrous because no one can control or predict what I'm going to do. I want to be a real participant in processes of social change, and I want to take it at my own pace, and that's fine. So that's a great demonstration of the clash of cultures, if you like, that exists in the world that we're talking about.
You include in the book some cautionary tales, like, for example, the Community Arts Exchange in Los Angeles. Tell us that story.
Well, Community Arts Exchange is a good example of a group that ran on, let's call it, traditional nonprofit principles, and then hired someone from Silicon Valley as part of this wider trend to import business leaders into the nonprofit sector on the ground that they would make it more efficient. But making it more efficient meant actually denuding it of much of what made it strong and effective in the first place, reorganizing it along business principles, cutting out programs which seemed to be more expensive than others, firing staff who didn't fit with the new culture, bringing in newcomers from the outside who didn't really have experience in what they were supposed to be doing, and at the end of the day, creating actually a much more fragile organization than was there in the first place. It's not an isolated instance. This is a story I hear time and time again from the grassroots of American civil society, but it's deeply disturbing and very frustrating, I think, to see people, I'm sure, with a great heart and complete sincerity, come into an area about which they know very little and simply assume that they know best. So that's the moral of the story.
We're talking to Michael Edwards. His book is called Small Change, Why Business Won't Save the World. Microcredit is something that's gotten an awful lot of attention, and it seems to be one of those areas that it seems like you're using a business model on a very small scale with the poorest people in the world to actually bring them out of poverty and into the economic context in which they live. How's it working?
Well, it's been studied to an extent, and what the research tells us is that microcredit is extremely important and needs to be encouraged on a much bigger scale because it does give very poor people access to the loans they need to be safer, more secure, and more productive. But the research also suggests that it doesn't solve poverty on its own. To do that, you need other measures. Government intervention to provide a safety net, for example, large-scale intervention in health and education so that people have the services they need to be fully productive. So microcredit is an important part of solving global poverty, but by itself, it doesn't go very far. And if, you know, if you think about it, if microcredit was going to solve poverty, then countries with an effective banking system, like the United States, at least reasonably effective, you know, prior to the financial crash, would have solved poverty for themselves, and that's clearly not the case. So for me, microcredit is a good tale, but a cautionary tale that we're always going to need, if you like, non-economic interventions which are not based on the market, if we're going to solve the really big problems of the world like poverty and ill health. Microcredit will get you only so far in solving those problems, but we need to celebrate it for what it is. I think the problem comes when people, and this is a common tendency, I think, that we often have, tend to put all their eggs in one basket and tend to think of a panacea, a magic bullet for the problems of poverty and development. And there's a little bit of that about microcredit. That simply isn't true. But if we see it for what it is, a useful set of interventions which are partially effective in solving economic problems, then that's great, and we should do more of it.
You write about socially responsible businesses. Let's talk about that some more. What does it mean to be a socially responsible business? I know there's some, what do they call it, greenwashing, people doing stuff which is really just barely scratching the surface of the problems, but making a big deal out of it through their PR mechanisms. What is the model of a socially responsible business?
Well, it's a huge debate. You know, there are lots of different answers to that question, Mary Charlotte, and I think the crucial issue for me touches on the greenwashing issue that you mentioned, because a lot of corporate social responsibility is simply a more effective marketing, I think, of conventional products to people with very little social or environmental content. So let's leave that aside. I think there are two areas where social responsibility means or could mean a lot more, which will be revolutionary for the future. The first will be for business to fix itself rather than fix others, as I put it in the book, and that means generating more sustainable jobs with better salaries and benefits for workers. It means producing goods and services which have more social and environmental value and are less harmful to the world and to people in it. It means removing corporate lobbying from politics. It means getting corporations to pay their taxes, just like the rest of us, rather than escaping those obligations by shifting their sources offshore. It means doing all the things at the core of your business that would make you into a more socially responsible enterprise, rather than pretending that corporate social responsibility or corporate philanthropy is the logical end of that debate. So that's the first thing to do. Let's have business fix itself rather than fixating on others. The second is to go even further than that, and that's going a long way. We're going even further than that into what people have called new business models, and that means changing the whole basis on which corporations and markets currently work by getting more and more people involved in the ownership of enterprises and in sharing their benefits. So, for example, Wikipedia is a great example of a really useful public good which is actually produced collectively and whose benefits are owned by the whole community and not by a small group of shareholders, which is the problem with conventional business. You have cooperatives, production cooperatives, which I know are a little bit out of fashion, especially perhaps in the US, but if you look at examples like Mondragon, which originated in Spain, it's doubled in size every year for the last 10 years and now involves hundreds of thousands of workers who all share in the fruits of their production. It's not owned, as in a conventional business, by a tiny minority of people who appropriate profit to themselves. Or take something like community benefit agreements that are being used in lots of places in the U.S. A community benefit agreement means that a store like Walmart, for example, or a big business that's coming into an area, has to negotiate and literally sign an agreement with representatives from the community who negotiate a better deal in terms of social benefits, the preservation of small businesses, investment in infrastructure for the community, and so on. So that's a way of capturing more of the benefits of capitalism for ordinary people. And I think that's the future of socially responsible business. It's not tinkering around the edges. It's not corporate philanthropy. It's not accruing huge endowments in corporate foundations. It's actually changing the basis on which capitalism works so that all of us can share its benefits and reduce its cost. I think if that's what this debate is about, then it's going to be much more interesting and much more exciting and eventually much more effective, because I think it will create a different form of economic system, and that's where we need to be heading.
The motivation for that change is something that I think needs to be talked about a lot. I mean, as we've seen in Wall Street and in many examples, when you, for example, deregulate a corporation so that it can make more money, that money doesn't trickle down. On the contrary, it feeds a whole rush of greed and people get poorer rather than any kinds of problems of poverty being solved. There's a quotation in your book from somebody from the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies that says, a responsible company is one that is required to be responsible by law. They don't seem to do it themselves.
Well, that's a good question. You know, that's where the rubber hits the road, I think. I mean, in my view, trickle-down economics never works. It's always been a myth, a convenient myth, I think, that if only we allow capitalism to function in the free market sense, the rest of us will somehow eventually benefit in some shape or form. But we've been trying that for 50 years or more, and it still hasn't worked. So doing more of the same is very unlikely to get us where we want to go. The problem, of course, is that no one wants involuntary regulation. No one wants to be told what to do by government. That sticks in the craw, I think, of any business person worth the name. And that's why there's so much attention to voluntary regulation, to codes of conduct, to things that business can do for themselves without having to be regulated by law. So it's a very difficult question. This, my own view is that eventually, as that quotation that you read indicates, you do have to have some legal basis for corporate social responsibility. Otherwise, it's too easy for corporations to escape those responsibilities by saying that it's too difficult, or we'll do it next year, or the economic recession makes it impossible for us to innovate, and all the things that you tend to hear. On the other hand, if government interferes too much in the operations of business and the market, there will be some nasty shocks around. We know that. So you have to get the balance right. And it's getting the balance right that is the job of government. And any government worth its salt, you know, should have that at the center of its agenda, as I think the current one is trying to do, whether one agrees with where it comes out or not. So clearly, a mixture of voluntary and involuntary incentives, let's put it that way, are going to be important for the future. But we can't simply hope that business will fix itself by itself. That's unrealistic and somewhat naive, I think, given the realities that we're facing. So I am a supporter of government intervention and government regulation where it makes sense. But I also think it's important to leave business to do what it does best and not to get in the way too much.
Well, the places where it does best, I mean, are probably fairly obvious to people in the sense of providing things that we need to consumers at a price that they can afford. You know, every time I go into the drugstore and buy a bottle of aspirin, I think, you know, this is the marketplace at work. I mean, there's hundreds of things like that, you know, food and clothing and so on that we use every day. But the thing that business doesn't do well at all is, for example, deal with pollution. And I can't imagine any voluntary culture in which businesses would ever deal with pollution in a way that is necessary. I mean, when you think about the amount of plastic in the ocean right now, it's so staggering, and it's such a tremendous emergency, and business doesn't care at all.
I think that's right. I mean, there are going to be areas where only an outsider, if you like, a government in this case, can change the rules of the game so that the incentives for business start to move them in the direction of conservation rather than pollution. I mean, if the incentives aren't there, if costs aren't internalized, then why would one expect them to do any of those things? It's illogical. So I think you're absolutely right in the sense that one has to change the rule of the game, the rules of the game, so that people start to play in a different way. If the game remains the same, then they'll just keep on doing the same things. So I think there's still, though, a lot of room for maneuver, still a lot of potential in supporting deep innovations in business, which some of the real pioneers are doing, the ones that I mentioned, new business models and common space production and community benefit agreements and worker-owned firms and cooperatives and so on. I still think that there's a lot of potential that hasn't been unlocked. So it's not just, I think, an issue of tightening the regulations over pollution and other what are called in the jargon externalities. It's also a case of being braver and more courageous and more imaginative and more creative in transforming capitalism in ways that we only have a brief inkling about at the moment. Because I think if you focus too much on regulation, then it becomes a sort of zero-sum game, a fight between business who resist and government who insists. And that will only get you so far. I think unlocking the more creative potential of capitalism to be different, to be a different form of economic system from the inside is also very important. And you can't legislate for that.
Interesting. I mean, I think there's also the question of which which problems can be solved in which ways. So, for example, pollution really can't be solved by lots of little people from the ladies' auxiliary going up and picking up the trash, because we can't go into the middle of the ocean and do that. That has to be a regulatory effort. It, I mean, anything else is just you're dreaming. And, you know, so what problems can be solved through this more creative new model that you're talking about?
Well, I think that that's a very good question. I think if you look at the really big problems of pollution, minimum wages, working conditions, things like that, you have to have central government intervention, because that's a complete game changer. You know, if wages rise in one part of the country and not another, then you'll get migration of business and the loss of jobs in one place and the gain in others. So you have to have some large scale, official, coordinated response to those really big problems of the economy. I certainly wouldn't disagree with that. On the other hand, we all know that innovation tends to thrive on a smaller scale. That's where you get new ideas, new things being brought to the table, new technologies being invented. Tends to be not officially mandated by government, and certainly not actually launched by very large corporations who monopolize areas of the economy. It tends to come from people in their backyards, in their garages, inventing new things, thinking in new ways, taking risks, you know, doing things which seem crazy probably at the time, but over the time they take in the system, they develop laptop computers, cell phones, iPods, you know, new green technologies, all started in that way. So you're right that we had to be very clear with each other what kinds of problems fall into which category, and I think they're taking us back to where we started. That's another reason for just being more sophisticated about this stuff and being able to be very clear and to be very honest with each other where you use particular instruments. What worries me about a lot of the debate at the moment is it's not sophisticated in that way. It simply says that here we assume to have a solution which works in one place, so let's just use it somewhere else and assume that it's going to work just as effectively there. That's the opposite of the kind of sophistication I think that you're talking about. And I really wish the debate would head in that direction. But that's only possible if everyone is more open, I think, to different views and has a basic sense of humility that, yes, they might be successful in one part of the world, but they're not necessarily going to be successful in another, and to make room for lots of different approaches to take root in that ecosystem that you mentioned. That, to me, is both healthier and more democratic, and that will be more effective in surfacing lots of innovations to social and economic problems in the future. So for me, getting more democracy into both the economic and the political system is vital.
You give some examples of foreign aid and of very well-financed philanthropic charities operating overseas, and part of the problem that you have there is when you impose, you know, the American business model or the American way of doing things on other people and don't really listen to what they have come up with. You're both insulting it and infantilizing them, but also often wasting a whole lot of money, and you give some examples of this.
Yes, you know, there are the great evaluations from the Gates Foundation and others, and kudos to Gates for actually releasing them in the public domain. That's quite a brave thing to do, which show that when you try and import those foreign models into the local arena, you end up with some very predictable failures, huge cost overruns, people who don't understand what's going on, services that are inappropriate or too expensive to pay for or for government to take over in the long term. This is especially the case in a lot of health programs that are financed by the new philanthropy. I mean, these, to be honest, are lessons that we should have learned many, many years ago, because they have infected the world of foreign aid for generations. But I think there's a tendency not to learn from experience in philanthropy and in foreign aid, and that means that people are constantly making and repeating the same mistakes, however basic they may seem when you analyze them. So we're still retailing the same problems, I think, in many of the aid programs that we're funding. The basic principle of effective foreign aid, that's the world I've been involved in now for almost 30 years, is that you have to find out what people really care about, and you have to understand how they solve problems for themselves, and then maybe you can be supportive to them, you can help them, you can nurture their own creativity, and their ability to identify and solve problems for themselves. So you can be useful as an outsider, that's definitely true, but you had to be extremely sensitive and careful and slow-moving about it in the ways that we were saying before. The worry, I think, or my worry, is that this new generation of philanthropists, because they haven't come from this world, don't have access to the lessons of experience that we've been learning over the last 30 or 40 years, and that therefore there's even more of a tendency to repeat the same mistakes, however obvious they are. I guess, you know, maybe it's inevitable that every generation repeats the mistakes of its predecessor, but there must be a better way of doing things because it's extremely ineffective, both in economic terms and in social and political terms. But what I argue for in the book is, if you like, a crash course, more of an education for the new philanthropists in the realities of social change on the ground in different contexts, so that at least they will be faced with grassroots realities and wouldn't simply be able to retail the kind of techniques and models that they use in their business life in other people's societies. But that requires, I think, a more honest conversation about the strengths and weaknesses of this movement, and less hubris and more humility about what it can achieve.
Have you had success through this book and through your work in fostering those conversations among the people that you think need to hear them?
Well, it's interesting. You know, a lot of people who I talk to automatically can feel that people must be against what I'm saying. But that's not been the case at all. I mean, it certainly varies. I've had some very hostile reactions, but also a lot of very positive ones, partly because people want to learn. I think a characteristic of successful entrepreneurs is that they want to learn new ways, new and more effective ways of doing things. So if someone comes to them and says, well, look, there may be a problem here, or have you thought of this? Or have you looked at the research? They're not closed to that. And so I think for those people, this is a great opportunity to improve what they're doing and be even more successful in the future, even if it challenges some of the basic preconceptions and assumptions that they bring to the table. So it really comes down to human beings in their own individual nature. You know, are you open enough to accept that you don't have all the answers and participate in a dialogue with others that might find a better way forward? Or do you really think that you know best and therefore it's not worth talking to anyone else? And there are examples of both those personalities and the people I deal with, but fortunately more of the first than the second.
As I was reading your book, it struck me over and over again in different ways that culture is so much a part of all of this. So, for example, I just read Greg Mortensen's new book, Stones Into Schools, and what was really striking about that was he really operates as a humble individual going around by himself and doing grassroots work. And the kind of work that he's doing is really contrasted with the people from foreign aid nonprofits going around with like little satellite dishes on the roof of their air-conditioned minivans and so on. And it's a culture clash between people from these maybe wonderful but very well-funded foundations whose individuals would never think of going along in a bumpy old car driven by a local. And when you're not willing to do that, how can you possibly get anywhere?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. That's the basic cancer that's infected foreign aid for a generation or more, the feeling that we know best and simply have to deliver something into other people's societies and make it work, which, of course, never works. It always fails. So Greg's approach, you know, based on going to where people are, listening they are, and then working very carefully with them is vital. It doesn't mean that outsiders have nothing to offer, and I'm sure he's not saying that. You know, we have a lot to offer, but you place what your knowledge and your capacity at the service of others in the same way that we were talking about capitalism being the servant of democracy in the public interest. You know, if you have resources, whether they're financial resources or intellectual or technical resources, that can help to liberate people from conditions of poverty, then use them, but use them constructively and in a very careful and sophisticated way. I think that's the basic message. And then people enjoy that. You know, they respond positively, because why wouldn't they? You know, so there's an old saying that if you come to me claiming that you'll help me, then I'll say goodbye. But if you come to me because your liberation is bound up in mine, then we can work together. And I think that captures the essence of the culture and the attitudes that we need to be helpful to others. we are all bound up with each other's liberation, and we need to recognize and work from that basic principle. When we do that, we will be successful, and all of us will share in the benefits.
There are a few examples that you have that are successes of a business model and a service model working side by side. Planned Parenthood is one of them. They upgraded their clinics and took clients who paid full price and used that to subsidize clients who couldn't pay. And I'm surprised that that's not a more common working model. Why is that so hard to do?
Well, I think it's because it's so hard to do that it's relatively rare. You know, it sounds great, and obviously you can make it work very effectively, but there's nothing automatic, because the more you bend towards the market, as in that case, launching clinics for customers who can pay higher prices, the greater the danger of mission drift. So there isn't an automatic gain or benefit in following that model. You need to be very, very careful, very, very sophisticated, and always have a very good monitoring system, which will tell you when mission drift that we spoke about earlier is beginning to enter into the picture. Because let's face it, the more profit you make, the more money you make, the greater the temptation to go further in that direction. But the further you go in that direction, the greater the danger that you move away from your original mission to serve the underprivileged who can't afford to pay for those services. So the profit motive is very seductive, you know, and you have to be very savvy, I think, to the dangers of going too far in that direction. So it is a great model, so long as you remember that and you always keep things in a careful balance. But you must be able to know, if you like, when you're being seduced in that direction and take the appropriate action to bring yourself back to what you're supposed to be doing in the first place, which has nothing to do with making money. So it's a technique. It's not an end in itself, but you must use it in a very sophisticated way. So that's difficult to do, and I think that's why it isn't adopted more widely.
When you talk about the problems in this world that need solving, and you know the subtitle of your book is Why Business Won't Save the World, there's a big elephant in the middle of the coffee table for me, and that is that so much of the world seems to be run by what amount to mafias, not only the drug cartels, but the military establishments, the military contractors, and these giant corporations, which act without the slightest hint of caring for the environment or for human beings. And in fact, for them, all of life seems to be A, disposable, and B, at the service of their profit.
Well, that is true, and I wouldn't argue against that. It's a depressing picture. But I think it has to be countered by what's in our DNA as citizens, which is a struggle against those forces. None of us like to be have our feet held to the fire by unaccountable forces. None of us want our politics to be distorted and dominated in that way. All of us want to participate more effectively in our society in every possible sense. And so I think there's something very, very basic about human beings that makes them resist and struggle against and organize against the forces that you describe. It doesn't mean that they're successful. You know, I'm not romantic about this. I've been involved in community organizing and social struggles my whole life. So I know what we're up against. I know how difficult it is. But that doesn't stop us from trying. And I think the way I see philanthropy is as a potential system to help us to be more effective in doing precisely that. That may not be where philanthropy is now, but it is where it could be. And I spend a lot of time at the end of the book spitting that out in under what I call citizen philanthropy as a label, a way of empowering and bringing all of us, or as many of us as possible, to the table so that we can all be philanthropists, we can all share in defining which problems are going to be solved and how, so that we can build our capacities to participate in politics and in civic life and in economics, and so that we bring a greater portion of democracy really to the way everything is run. That's the only way in the long term that we will be able to counter and potentially overcome the forces, the mafias, the corruption, the domination, the power and so on that you describe, you know, very eloquently. So for me, that may be a real picture of the world as it is, but it's not necessarily a picture of where we can be in a generation or more if we as citizens come together and advance our own interests powerfully and collectively. And philanthropy should be supporting those efforts. And that's why I'm worried about some current trends which are in the opposite direction. But I think that's a call to action. and a call to action which resonates very powerfully whichever society you live in, whether it's Santa Fe or Afghanistan or France or Britain, where I come from. We as citizens have an innate power within ourselves and our communities to make changes, and we can make them bigger or smaller, but that's our job.
Michael Edwards is author of the book Small Change, Why Business Won't Save the World. He is affiliated with the think tank Demos and the Wagner School of Public Service at New York University and many other institutions. Thank you so much for spending all this time with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
My pleasure, Mary Charlotte. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find me at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. Thank you.